Careful about this.
Exactly. So now I guess it's time for us to go for a short break and then we'll be back. Today's episode of Muslim Lady, we're talking about the way the greatest lady in this world, Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah alayha, treated her children. The woman whose father actually been treating all the children pretty much in a cool manner, in a very much perfect, kind manner. He was always greeting them even before they say hello to him. So he was actually very much kind toward all the children. Now, from this father comes such a mother who's been so kind to all children and also to everyone else, actually.
You quoted this very beautiful narration wherein, like, Prophet, peace be upon him, would go and he would start greeting children before they would come and...
Yeah, and he them. Even played with them.
Then he played with them and yeah. Then he would laugh with them, giggle around, and which we consider as, oh, come on, I am elder one and I should...
He is the prophet, you know? He is the prophet, knowing that he has such a place, such an importance in society.
Position in society.
He was so modest and so kind toward all, and specifically to children.
You know, in Surah Waqia, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that there are three groups of people, like there are Ashab al-Shimal, there are Ashab al-Yameen, and there are Sabiqoon. Mm-hmm. Those, the ones Sabiqoon are the ones who overtake.
Yeah.
Al-Yameen are the ones who are the righteous people, but they are like kind of little lazy in doing things. Like they won't overtake. And Shimal are the wrongdoers. So how are we not going to discuss about these groups? Why are discussed as Sabiqoon as Sabiqoon? These are the overtakers.
Exactly.
These are in the front line always. Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. They have always been among the Sabiqoon and Sabiqoon. These are the practical examples of the Sabiqoon who overtake, who are the first to do.
Mm. You know, whenever they are the ones who take the initiative for everything.
That is who are called Sabiqoon. You know, Sabiqoon are the ones who take initiative, who want to do every kindness, every goodness first.
Yeah.
So he would do salam to children, he would play with children, even her daughter. So when we are talking about she gave importance to spiritual growth, she gave importance to the physical growth, equally she gave importance to the emotional growth of her children.
Mm-hmm.
And in emotional growth, there are so many research done which say that if you do not give emotional attention to your children, they are going to grow up, they are going to come out, they are going to be, when they become adults, they're going to be like... Some people have aggressive behavior.
And they would have traumas, of course.
They have traumas. They go through some psychological disorders and they have so many, you know, problems.
Consequences would come.
Exactly. If you do not pay emotional attention, and that's all proven now, you know.
Yeah. Everyone knows psychologically and scientifically.
And how in that time, in that period, when the education was not so much in advance.
So primitive. Everything was so primitive.
She gave the utmost importance to this aspect, the emotional aspect. And in the meantime, she would not ignore her husband.
This is the point. You know, women are doing too much of a job.
Yeah, because I as a woman, when I'm playing with my kids, I'll say, I don't have time for my husband.
Exactly.
But see her tricky way and her...
And when are you going to make food?
Her actual wise way of playing with kids.
Yeah.
She would play with Imam Hassan alayhi salam and say, Ishba abaka ya Hassan, waqla'ana al-haqqa rasan. Which means, be like your father, O Hassan. Remove the rope of oppression from the neck of truth.
Yeah.
So she's playing with her son, teaching him the spiritual aspect.
So this is her nursery rhyme.
Yeah. And also giving attention to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing three things.
Multitasking.
At the same time.
Yeah.
And I, as a Muslim lady today, have all the excuses, all the, you know, I have pretexts for myself. How can I handle all that? Mm,
I can't do all these things at the
just
same
time.
Just see
how she is doing mm-hmm. in a very, very wise way, in a very, very intelligent manner, how she's playing with Imam Hasan alayhi salam. So in the further couplets of her nursery rhyme, she would recite, وَعَبُدْ إِلَٰهًا زِلْمِنًا, and worship the Lord who gives you bounties. وَلَا تُوَالِ زِلْعِهًا, and do not get closer to those who keep grudges.
Exactly, yeah.
Teaching him ethics at the same time, teaching him about God at the same time, teaching yeah. him how, you know, merciful Allah is, how he is the owner of all bounties.
If very have, wise of her yeah, as a mother.
These
at the same time that she's playing with them, she's reciting, singing for them this nursery rhyme. And this nursery rhyme has got a lot to say at the very same time.
Indeed.
Yeah. So let's go for a short break, and then we would have some more minutes to wrap it all up.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Dear Muslim ladies, we are talking about the way Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha behaved with her children, the way she treated them. We talked about a spiritual growth. We talked about the physical growth and also the emotional growth. And we said that at that very time where everything was so primitive, such a great woman had too much of understanding of the psyche of her children in a way that she did not ignore any single specific detail about their growth. And Sister Zainab actually helped us with that. And I guess that's all about the behavior that
yeah, exactly.
the mothers
would have
with
their children. I actually didn't want to make a confusion that it's just the spiritual aspect. The emotional aspect is equally important. The physical
of
aspect mm-hmm. of their growth is equally important. All the aspects are very, very important. However, she did not just prioritize the, you know, other stuff that we do today, actually. I gave the examples.
Exactly, yeah.
Schooling is important. Choosing a school is very, very important. But it's not like sometimes what we do is we realize secular education is being given in a school, but they're reject the Islamic knowledge, or they are teaching, they are
exactly.
actually infusing something
and
else.
Also I
we
would
prefer
say that,
that school mm-hmm. over any other school wherein Islamic teaching is given. So that should not be done. What I'm trying to say is that spiritual aspect should not be ignored, or the material aspect should not be given priority over the spiritual
it shouldn't be prioritized to other needs of the children. And also I would think that giving a perfect schooling to a child is very much important, but the attention and the care that the child needs from their parents, specifically from the mothers, because they spend more time with them, is something that is indispensable.
You
cannot
you
change it with anything
you
else.
You actually have to be, you know, be very, very careful when
yeah.
it comes to upbringing, because Lady Fatima Zahra Salam is teaching us so much. The emotional aspect, the physical aspect, the spiritual aspect, nothing should be ignored.
Exactly.
And what I would like to say then to all women, listen to your children. Because a child does not say, I am stressed or I'm distressed. What a child says is that, can you play with me?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the point. So you must have a plan as a Muslim woman. And then you must prioritize the needs of your children and listen to them. And then be with them always, be their shoulder. And that's it. Yeah, that's all the mothers, kind mothers would do with their children. Thank you, Muslim ladies. Until another session, I say farewell and may Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puriza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of bed and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Yeah. Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On Saturday, protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan, and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
Noi oggi siamo.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his country to destruction for a war that had been planned for years by the U.S.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kiev is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kiev with more weapons.
Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. Rai and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kiev is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow, and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard. And in Ukraine's reconstruction, Max Civili, Rome.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital, Beirut, to show solidarity with the Syrian people who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called Caesar Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians, and representatives of the Resistance Front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut, the National Media Association announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions off Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still like turning around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least five rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Ibrahim Raisi is in Beijing for a three-day state visit. That's the first such trip by an Iranian president to China in 20 years. Upon his arrival, he was welcomed by his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. During their meeting, the two presidents sounded determined to strengthen the two countries' partnership, both vowing to work toward implementation of the 25-year Strategic Cooperation Pact, whatever international conditions be.
We believe that implementing the 25-year cooperation agreement and realizing what agreed between the two countries' officials today to develop bilateral ties can promote regional and global peace and stability. Certainly, relations between Iran and China will not be affected by international developments, since we're determined to develop ties with China in any circumstances.
China will continue to be committed to consolidating and deepening relations with Iran. I'm willing to work with President Raisi to enhance strategic communication and promote the steady and sustained growth of the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries.
Of course, the two presidents had much more to say. Raisi said there is still much more for expanding economic and trade collaboration between the two sides, adding that such collaboration would contribute to peace and stability across the globe. On the other side, she hailed China's growing solidarity with Tehran, saying the two countries have supported each other in the face of complex global challenges. He added that China supports Iran's efforts to safeguard its national sovereignty and independence and counter hegemony and unilateralism. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says further deepening of Iran-China ties will greatly strengthen the developments of a multipolar world.
The deepening of ties further strengthens the development of a multipolar world against what both the Chinese and the Iranians said was the ongoing hegemony and unilateralism of Western domination, specifically led by the United States.
Iranian academic Said Mohammad Marandi, who is accompanying the Iranian delegation in Beijing, says the West's antagonistic attitude has accelerated convergence among Asian nations.
Asia alone, through this natural convergence, which is being pushed forward even faster, largely due to the fact that the United States and the Europeans are constantly antagonizing governments and sanctioning governments, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, and increasingly China, and also by constantly trying to prevent India from establishing greater ties with these Asian powers, the United States and Europeans are pushing these countries towards greater convergence at a faster pace.
Tehran-Beijing cooperation has been only growing over the past couple of years. China has now become Iran's largest trading partner, with figures showing volume of trade between the two rose by over 40% in the previous Iranian calendar year, which ended on March the 20th. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. Iran is also eager to contribute to China's mega project, the Belt and Road Initiative. China and Iran now appear set to take their partnership to the next level for prosperity of their nations.
Once again, the International Fajr Film Festival brought together filmmakers and movie critics from across the world, as well as movie lovers, this time for its 41st edition. A festival made even more special considering that the international section was reintegrated into the national festival after 6 years of holding separate events.
This year, 26 feature-length movies from 25 countries were competing in the international section. For many of them, this is their regional premiere. The movie market also allows producers and filmmakers to get to know each other and negotiate further cooperation.
I've attended the festival on behalf of the Ministry of Culture of Russia, and based on what I've seen in the past 10 days, I believe that there is a great potential for joint production.
And for those keeping an eye on the festival, the award ceremony was what they'd been waiting for.
Jaishan Kalariar, the director of this movie.
Our jury made a slight change to the order. You'll know that it's initially for best director, but we decided that instead we would like very much to give it to a new and promising filmmaker who's both written and directed his film. So congratulations to him.
I would like to dedicate this award for the three filmmakers whom I admire, Mr. Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi.
I'm an engineer by profession, but when I got a lot of free time, I used to watch a lot of cinema. And when I watched Iranian films, they had a great influence in my style. And three filmmakers, specific, Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi have influenced my filmmaking style a lot. And my film is a byproduct of their films.
In the national section, 24 movies were picked out of 87 entries to compete for the top award. What made the national section stand out this year was a whole new generation of first-time directors from different provinces across the country.
Taking part in a festival is what motivates most of us working in the business, and I can tell you for sure that the competition was really tough this year with young up-and-coming directors who participated.
As far as I know, there were lots of young directors taking part this year, so I can tell you for sure that this wasn't an easy competition.
With all of its glitz and glamour and prestige, the 41st Fadj International Film Festival has come to an end, but this time promising new horizons for first-time directors. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Perhaps anticipating a hero's welcome, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky traveled to the Belgian capital on Thursday with a list of demands. He has asked for long-range missiles and warplanes to use against Russian forces. He also wants Kiev to be granted EU membership without delay.
Of course, membership, and that's why, of course, we need it this year. And this year, Charles, when I say this year, I mean this year.
Those with intimate knowledge of how the EU works believe it is a pipe dream.
Turkey will not be pleased because they are already waiting since 2005 in formal discussions. Then we have the Western Balkans. Also there, something is boiling in Bosnia and Serbia. So these countries, they will say, wait a minute, what about us? And for sure, there are definitely member states who will block this.
EU leaders concluded their latest summit on Friday. The most up-to-date cost of supporting Ukraine was revealed. And it's eye-watering.
67 billion of support we have mobilized in the last 12 months, from budget support to fast recovery, from energy supply to military capabilities, from humanitarian aid to refugee support. And we must do more.
A number of EU lawmakers encourage solidarity with Ukraine, but also want support for the bloc's own hard-pressed citizens.
Solidarity with our most vulnerable, who struggle to put food on the table or heat the home, or those in difficulty maintaining a roof over their heads.
While Zelensky was touring Europe, who was running the show back in Kiev? US and NATO commanders? The Kremlin has warned Western powers not to become too involved in the conflict. There's no doubt EU citizens have a great deal of sympathy and empathy for the people of Ukraine, but there's growing concern about the level of pressure, some might call it provocation, being exerted on Russia by Western leaders. Many are nervously asking, when might Putin say, enough is enough? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The Zionist regime's new fascist government has intensified its attacks against Palestinians, which constitutes a war crime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, in a little over a month, the Zionist regime's prime minister has killed Palestinians, demolished their homes, mounted incursions into occupied Palestinian territory, and endeavored to change laws and policies to accelerate the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians from Palestine. This year marks the 75th anniversary of Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. In 1948, the Zionist regime assumed control over more than three-quarters of Palestine. Upwards of 700,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes or forced to flee, and the Zionist regime confiscated much of the land. Now, the Zionist regime's new extremist government, the most anti-Palestinian in the Zionist regime's history, aims to finish the job by incorporating all of the occupied Palestinian territories. Bezalel Smotrich, head of the Zionism Party, is the new Minister of Finance. In 2021, he told Arab members of the Israeli regime Knesset that they were here by mistake because Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job and throw you out in 1948. In his effort to Judaize the occupied West Bank and East al-Quds, the Zionist regime may be trying to cleanse the Palestinians from them. Richard Falk, former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, wrote an email to Truth Out, "The new Israeli government is the culmination of decades of apartheid subjugation of the Palestinian people in their homeland." In 1967, the Zionist regime attacked Egypt, Jordan, and Syria and seized the Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds, as well as the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. Palestinians called this the Nakba. It ushered in the Zionist regime's prolonged occupation of Palestinian territory, but UN Security Council Resolution 242 passed in 1967 and reaffirmed in 2016, stipulates the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, has documented killings, house demolitions, and incursions by the Zionist regime's occupying forces, IOF, against Palestinians since the beginning of 2023. 43 Palestinians, including 19 civilians, 7 of whom were children, were killed by the IOF. 3 Palestinians were killed by settlers, allegedly in retaliation for shooting and stabbing attacks, and dozens were injured in the occupied West Bank, including East al-Quds. The 4th Geneva Convention forbids the punishment of people in an occupied territory for offenses they didn't personally commit. The Zionist regime's reprisals against families and the community for actions they did not take constitutes collective punishment, which is considered a war crime. In addition, the IOF rendered 33 families homeless, a total of 229 individuals, including 43 women and 108 children. This was the result of IOF demolitions of 34 houses. 6 were forced to demolish their own homes, and 3 were demolished in an exercise of collective punishment. The IOF also demolished 39 other civilian objects, razed other property, and delivered dozens of notices of demolition, cease construction, and evacuation in the West Bank, including East al-Quds, PCHR reported. IOF conducted 1,449 incursions into the West Bank, including occupied East al-Quds, since the beginning of 2023. During these incursions, 638 Palestinians were arrested, including 11 women and 61 children. Moreover, 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in 18 years. The IOF killed at least 146 Palestinians, including 34 children. The new Zionist coalition government has begun the process to prevent the Israeli regime's Supreme Court from overruling legislation passed by the Knesset. There are proposals for the coalition to select judges and replace professional legal advisors with political appointees. The new regime has also withheld nearly $40 million in Palestinian tax revenues and plans to divert that money to victims of Palestinian attacks. Meanwhile, guidelines published by the government call for more construction of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank, legalization of illegal outposts, and eventual full annexation of the West Bank. The Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits an occupying power from transferring parts of its own civilian population to the territories it occupies. It is illegal for the Zionist regime to directly or tacitly support the building of Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. In 2016, the UN Security Council adopted Resolution 2334, which condemned the fabricated regime of Israel for the establishment of settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Al-Quds. It says that the building of settlements has no legal validity and constitutes a flagrant violation under international law. Approximately 650,000 Jewish settlers live in 164 settlements and 116 outposts in the occupied West Bank. Settlers who illegally build settlements on Palestinian territory have been emboldened by the new regime, which includes leaders for the settler movement among its key ministers. Also, the website of Middle East Eye noted Netanyahu's strategy was exposed last week when the Zionist regime's army raided the Palestinian town of Jenin, killing 10 Palestinians, including an elderly woman. That raid, as well as the provocative visit to Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Zionist regime's far-right security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, triggered the beginning of the collapse of Netanyahu doctrine. In April 2002, the Zionist regime forces stormed the camp, killing more than 50 Palestinians. Around 2 dozen Israeli regime troops were also killed in the operation. Many of Jenin's youth who are fighting the war today were babies or were not yet born during the Second Intifada. But the city's history of resistance is engraved into their identity, serving as motivation for their revolutionary actions against the Zionist regime occupation. Located on the periphery of the occupied West Bank, Jenin is geographically very close to Israel, which has facilitated Palestinian operations inside the country. And as the Zionist settlements continue to grow across the West Bank, separating the two regions is proving to be impossible.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher. An introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding prominent Shiite scholars and thinkers all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Om, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the main outstanding Shiite fuqaha of the 8th century Hijra. He is mainly known as Shaykh al-Shahid or Shahid al-Awwal, Muhammad ibn Jamaluddin Makki al-Amali, the author of Al-Lumat al-Lamashqiyah. We'll get to this book. But before that, let's be more familiar with the outstanding scholar from your tongue, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Shahid Awwal was born in Jabal al-Amil.
Yes.
We have most of our scholars from the Lebanon, basically. And he was also from Lebanon, the place Jabal al-Amil. And obviously he was known as Sheikh al-Ta'ifa. Some of the scholars have named him as Sheikh al-Ta'ifa or, you know, Imam al-Faqih or Sheikh al-Shahid.
Yes.
Because of the martyrdom that he had. He got martyred. So basically he was one of the famous scholars, one of the famous researchers, the Islamic scholars, and the student of Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, when we talk about Shahid Awwal, we know that he was one of the famous scholars, and he was a scholar who had the good knowledge of all the school of thoughts.
Yes.
Of Islam.
Yes.
Where we call them as the Arba'a Madhahib.
Yes.
The four schools. The
schools of
Ahl Sunnah.
Ahl Sunnah, that's right.
Because the Shia is different from the Ahl Sunnah. When we talk about the four schools, it's mainly referred to the Sunni school of thought, because Hanafiya, Shafi'iyya, Hanbaliyya. So these were known as the four schools. So he was one of the great scholars, and the status that he had, obviously, he had three children who were also the famous personalities. And obviously, because he was one of the great scholars, therefore we have many other scholars who have talked about him, and they have praised him,
mm-hmm.
especially about his status. Whereas we know that in today's world, and even in the amongst the fuqaha, it was famous that the one who can interpret the book of Shahid Awwal, he does not need to learn the jurisprudence.
Yes.
He is a faqih.
Yes.
Himself, the one who can solve this book.
Mm-hmm.
So basically he was someone who brought a revolution, we can say, in the Islamic jurisprudence. And after him, till today, we can see that in the Hawza, in the Islamic seminary,
yes.
everyone studies his book.
His book, that's right. We'll get to his book and his own explanation on the Lumat al-Damashqiyya. But before that, Shaykh Rouhani, give us a picture of the era in which Shahid al-Awwal lived, you know, up to an extent that he was martyred. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of his life.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, Shahid al-Awwal, Rahmatullahi alayhi, was one of the great scholars of Tashayyu in the history. But unfortunately, of course, as Shia in the history of Islam, the Shia scholars, the Shia people were oppressed always by the evil rulers,
yes.
same as their imams. So, of course, this Shahid al-Madhloom was also martyred by a group of people in Sham. Actually, first he was imprisoned by them,
mm-hmm.
and then finally he was martyred by them. And unfortunately, as it is mentioned in the history, even his dead body was burned by them.
What was the main reason, Sheikh Rouhani, for his martyrdom?
So you see that because of being the followers of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi uh-huh. wasalam, being Shia,
okay.
and in those area they were non-Shia people, the enemies of the Shia were living. That's why they arrested him, and finally, actually, he was martyred by them. This was the story, which is very, really sad, the story of his shahada, his martyrdom. And of course, I think he was very much influential figure in the history, because he had a contact with the Sarbadaran dynasty,
okay.
or the kings of Sarbadaran in Khorasan.
Mm-hmm.
They asked him to write a kind of instruction, a jurisprudential instruction for them. So that's why he wrote this Lum'at al-Dimashqiyya for these Salatin and for these Umara of Tashayyu in Khorasan.
Yes.
But he couldn't go to Khorasan, though he was invited by the last king of Sarbadaran,
yes.
to Khorasan, but he couldn't go there. That's why he wrote this kind of instruction for this group of people in Khorasan. That's why actually he paved the ground for more strengthenness of these kind of Shiite kind of dynasties,
yes.
and hukama or hukuma. So that's why he was also, we can say, a kind of politician or political,
yes.
figure in the history,
that's right.
because he supported these,
mm-hmm.
politicians. While
okay.
in the In Tashayyu, you know, and also our audience know that there are some scholars who believe that there shouldn't be any kind of hukuma or hakimiyya at the time of Ghaiba. But you see that this Shaheed al-Awwal, rahimahullah, supported this.
Yes.
Actually, Sarbadaran, it seems that, of course, he was not of the idea that at the time of Ghaiba, at the time of occultation, we shouldn't have any kind of hukuma or hakimiyya, while the Sarbadaran had their hukuma in Khorasan.
That's right.
By writing this book, by writing this instruction
and
for
the dedication of this book to Sarbadaran.
Course, of course. He admitted.
Yes.
He confessed that, this kind of movement in the history of the Shayu is okay, and there's no problem with that, I think.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
Al-Lumat al-Damashqiyya, Sayyid Muhsin, was written in the 8th century, we can say Hijra, in Arabic language. But still it is today used, we can say, and benefited from in the Islamic seminaries of both Qom, Mashhad, you know, Najaf, Karbala, everywhere, okay? So what is the significance of this book? What is this book exactly? Well, obviously, this book was, as our dear guest has mentioned, it was written on the request of the Sarbedaran. But it is also said that he wrote this book in 7 days. When it was requested by them, he was imprisoned in Syria. And then there, in 7 days, he wrote this book. Now, the significance of this book is because Shaheed was, he studied in the Syria. Mm-hmm. He was living in the Syria initially. Yes. And he was amongst the Sunni scholars as well. And the Sunni scholars used to come to his speeches, and he had a good relation with them. He also knew the fiqh or the jurisprudence related to the Ahl Sunnah.
Okay.
Therefore, when he wrote the book, it was a kind of fatwa, like the rulings, direct rulings. And in some portions, he also brought the reasoning why we need to follow this rule. So the both things were there. By looking at the Sunni sources and the Shia sources, obviously, because when he's bringing a reason that why we do this, and the reason why the Ahl Sunnah does this and we do not do this, all these reasonings were there. Therefore, his rulings that he brought, we can say these were exact rulings. These were, we can say, obviously the things that he brought. He had a good view on all the aspects of the things, and then how, you know, one ruling was changed from one thing to the other school of thought, how it went. So according to that, when he wrote this, it was a comprehensive book which have 52 chapters, which is more than the chapters which are mentioned in the Wasail al-Shia. Obviously, Wasail al-Shia is the, we can say...
Is this again the Hadithi book, Al-Lu'mat al-Lamashqiyya?
It is Hadithi and Qur'ani both, because when he brings the proofs or the reasoning, there sometimes he mentions the, for example, you know, the verses of the Qur'an. For example, in the chapter of the, you know, we can say trade, there is a famous verse that we have, Ofu bil uqud, you must fulfill your promises. So on top of that, he used to bring the traditions as well. So it is a combination of all. We cannot say it's merely just the traditions.
But fiqh is the most outstanding, we can say, part of this book. Yes.
Yes, obviously. And fiqh is, you know, in the Quran generally, what happens is, why we go towards the tradition, there is one more difference. We need to clarify this. Because Quran talks about general rules. It does not go to the specifications that how you need to do. For example, Quran says that aqimus salat, you need to establish prayer.
Yes.
Now, how to perform the prayer, it is not in the Quran. These are the detail things. The detailed things are not in the Quran. The major and the general rule is there.
Yes.
Therefore, that's why we mention the, like, bring the verse first, and then for the details, we go towards the tradition.
Okay.
How to do this. That's why the books of the jurisprudence, all of them, they have the most portion is related to the traditions because of these details that we needed, which were given by the prophets and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi
wasalam. That's right. Okay, Shaykh Rouhani, what's your opinion on Al-Lummatul Damashqiyya? Well, what is this book exactly, Al-Lummatul Damashqiyya?
I think one of the very important characteristics of this book is this, that Shaheed al-Awwal collected, or actually wrote this book in a way that it is very, what we can say, short, mm-hmm. but at the same time very much meaningful.
Yes.
And he tried to write, for example, a collection of ahadith or ahkam of Islam in a very short kind of manner. That's important.
Okay.
Because the Salatin and Umara, the people who are so much busy, they do not have time to read everything in detail or to refer to in the detailed kind of sources. So that's why, because of this, even for Tullab, it later becomes a very much important book because it was very much short, mm-hmm. concise, and precise.
Okay.
So that's why then later many ulamas started to write explanation commentaries on this book. They are voluminous kind of works by the many ulamas and scholars like Shaheed al-Awwal and the rest of the ulama. Yes. On this book, I think one of the very important characteristics of this book is that it is precise and concise, and that is why all of the tulam, ulama, asathid, umara, hukama, and even normal people, all of them made use of this book in the history.
So nowadays, when a talaba, I mean, when an Islamic seminary student wants to read this book, does it need any prerequisite knowledge or preparation before that?
If you refer directly to Al-Lum'a al-Damashqiyya, yeah, of course you would understand the ahkam of Islam, because he wrote in a way that would be understandable for all the people.
Okay.
But of course, since it is a kind of summarization, or it's a kind of short book, that's why we need to the details as well.
Okay.
But if you study only this kind of short, expression of ahkam or fiqh, of course you got familiar with the main, actually, parts of fiqh, and you would understand the ahkam. That's why it's useful, and it was welcomed, and it was embraced by all the students or different people in the history.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Shaheed al-Awwal and his magnum opus, Al-Lummatul Damashqiyya. Some of the most outstanding explanations and commentaries written on this book are Tuhfatul Gharawiyya, Tawzihul Mushkilat, and also the most outstanding one, Al-Rawzatul Bahiyya fi Sharh Al-Lum'atul Damashqiyya by Shaheed al-Sani. We will dedicate a specific program to Shaheed al-Sani and his book Al-Rawzatul Bahiyya, this outstanding. May Allah bless the soul of the late Muhammad ibn Jamal al-Din Makki al-Amali, mainly known as Shaheed al-Awwal, or Shaykh al-Shaheed. As also Shaykh Rouhani mentioned, Jamadi al-Awwal 786, Shaheed al-Awwal was, we can say, executed in Damascus in a temple, and his body was burnt. This shows extreme animosity of his enemies to this outstanding man and a scholar. And Shaheed al-Awwal passed away in this way. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, the author of Al-Lummatul Damashqiyya. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information on this outstanding dignitary and other episodes of our program, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.